That was the great Etta Baker playing One Dime Blues. And today was the day she passed away in 2006 before we went to break. You heard Bruce Springsteen, who was born on this day in 1949, as we some incredible musicians born on this day, including John Coltrane, we heard at the beginning of the program. Right now, before we, let me remind you, listen to the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA-FM, the voice of the community. And support for WEAA is provided by Bosch, offering Bosch dishwashers at Bray and Scarf. And we are about, once again, to have a conversation with one of my favorite writers, James McBride, who joined us here last to talk about Song Yet Sung. Of course, he's written The Color of Water, which put him on the scene, became a real classic. Miracle of Santa Ana. And now he's written The Good Lord Bird. And James McBride, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
How are you?
Very good.
Good. Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, tweet us at Mark Steiner. You may have read about the book. You may have read his other books. James McBride, by the way, will also be coming to Baltimore this coming weekend. He's going to be at the Baltimore Book Festival this Saturday, and we'll get more exact information on timing before the end of the hour. And don't want to miss that conversation when he's in town. Again, once again, it's good to have you with us. I was been looking forward to reading this book a lot. And let's just take a step backwards. I just want to, before we get into the heart of the novel, there's a passion you have for historical novels. It's clear in the last few books.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, talk about that. I mean, why is that become your the place you've settled into?
Well, that's where I live now. I'm not really sure. I think partly because I think there's a I have a I suppose it seems romantic to me, this era that I'm writing about now, the 1850s. There's so many people around, you know, John Brown, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Julia Ward Howe, Emerson, Thoreau, they were all around. Susan B. Anthony. And, you know, there were no cell phones, and it was just different. It was a time when people, it was a time where heroes were arced out of history.
And also like in Song Yet Sung, I mean, that was another piece that kind of grabbed onto a period like that.
And that took place down in the Maryland
Eastern Shore.
Eastern Shore area. But Song Yet Sung was not funny.
No.
The Good Lord Bird is funny. And I did that intentionally.
Yeah, and some people, see, I'm glad you said that. That was one of the questions I was going to ask later on. But since you said that, I'll ask it now. You know, when you read this book, if you don't read it that way, if you don't see it as a humorous piece when you read it, and you do laugh out loud when you read this book, at different points in the book, and you don't get the satirical quality as well. People, and I've already heard people criticizing it because of the way it portrays some of the great heroes of the 19th century abolitionist movement.
You mean like Frederick Douglass?
Like Frederick Douglass.
Well, Frederick Douglass had two wives. He had a black wife and he had a white mistress that lived with him for a while. I mean that's, you know, that doesn't wash in Brooklyn. I don't know how that goes down in Maryland. But...
I think it's against the law here, too. I don't think it works too well.
So, you know, in a book of satire, how can you not have fun with that? I mean, I love Frederick Douglass. I love what he did. I respect him as a great leader and a great writer and a great orator. But he was no John Brown. John Brown was on a different level in some ways.
One of the things that I got from this, and I had this in my notes as well, what you just said, I was wrestling with how you treated the historical figure, Frederick Douglass, and then kind of thought, and John Brown, and let me take Harriet Tubman, though, because she was in the book for a period of time as he was in the center, neither one was the centerpiece of the book, but both important to it. You treated those two characters very differently.
Well, you have to remember that my previous book, Song Yet Sung, was based on Harriet Tubman's life, loosely.
Right.
And I just have a deep and abiding love and respect for her, probably deeper than that of Frederick Douglass. Because Harriet Tubman is truly misunderstood and misrepresented historically. She never wrote any books. Things were written about her. She rarely did interviews and was a person whose deep intellect was completely missed by historians, most historians. She does make an appearance in this book, and she comes off as a deeply mystical, yes, very wise woman.
Yes.
She's the only one. Everybody else, I make fun of everybody else.
That's true. And the description you have here up top, can I just read this? Because I love this piece, this little short description you have of Harriet Tubman when she's talking to Onion, who we'll talk about in a minute. Finally, she placed her small foot on the broom and stopped it. I had to look up to her then. Them eyes were staring down at me. I can't say they was kind eyes. Rather, they was tight as balled fists, full, firm, stirred. The wind seemed to live in that woman's face. Looking at her was like staring at a hurricane.
Well, listen, Harriet Tubman took 300 people and walked them to freedom through the most cleverest means imaginable. I don't know of anyone else in American history who has done something like that. So, and also, when she appears in the book, she appears during a convention in which John Brown is trying to raise money, and she turns the thing around. She gets these fancy, militants who talk, these political leaders who talk a lot and do nothing or do little to really, bone up and be men. And it was the moment where I felt that really happened, and I had to go with that.
No, it was good you did. I mean, that was a very powerful moment, and she's the role she played in this book, I think, was an important kind of what pushes the spirit of all this in many ways. As was what you just said, this whole idea you also kind of push in this book, whether it's Sibonia or Harriet Tubman, or is the idea of the or even Onion to an extent, the Onion as well is the power of women to give men backbone, to stand up. The whole question of questioning what gender means in terms of strength and who stands up.
Well, ultimately, I suppose The Good Lord Bird is a book about faith, because it talks so much about John Brown's faith, and then Onion, who spends the entire book as a boy playing as a girl, ultimately accepts God in his life. But it's true that the women in this book, the black women in this book, are very strong. And that's because they just were very strong. And also, during slavery, in the hierarchy of society, black women were at the very bottom of the food chain. And that's where you find most or many of your true heroes when you're a writer trolling for a good story.
And that was so the choice. I'm curious about, let's take that back. You just talked about Onion. Let's introduce Onion to the world here for a moment. Henry Shackelford, Henrietta Shackelford, Onion. That was also an interesting choice. I wanted to ask you, reading this, just what that choice was that you made in telling this story and telling it through this young boy's eyes, dressed up as a girl, being except for the slaves who always saw through it. The white folks.
Well, black women could see through his disguise quickly, but most other people couldn't see that he was really she was really a he, or didn't care enough to bother to investigate. But essentially, this book starts out in Kansas, where John Brown's war against slavery begins. He walks into a tavern where this 10-year-old kid is working with his father. His father's a barber, and the kid is a shoeshine boy, basically. John Brown announces he's an abolitionist. He's come to free every black person here. The thing goes bad. People start reaching for their guns. The boy's father's killed. John Brown snatches him and takes him with him, thinking that the boy, Henry, is a girl. And so he calls him Henrietta, and then he eventually calls him Onion, Little Onion. And Little Onion is his kind of good luck charm. And so this 10-year-old boy who plays as a girl is a witness to John Brown's entire life from Kansas, the bloody wars in Kansas, to Harper's Ferry, where John Brown attacked America's largest arsenal.
And the sojourn here with John Brown, the way you paint John Brown, and how he grows on you in this book. I'm also curious about that in terms of your research. I mean, because the personality of John Brown, who he was from the inside out, how much of that did you pull out of the research you did? How much of that did you kind of intuit from the research you did when you were discovering who this man was?
There's a lot written about him.
There is.
And most of what's in my book is true, except that I exaggerate his preacher-like propensities, propensity to preach. But 80% of what's written in The Good Lord Bird about John Brown is true. He was deeply religious. He would pull out his heater and drop the hammer on it in a hurry if you were on the wrong side of slavery. He did lecture to God about people that he came into contact with. He was ripe for caricature. You talk about Frederick Douglass. I mean, the book is essentially about Little Onion and John Brown. And
right.
John Brown is a caricature throughout the book.
He is. But it's a respectful caricature, even though it's funny.
Yeah. It's very respectful and it's very funny. I suppose, are you saying that the Frederick Douglass caricature is not that respectful?
Am I saying that Frederick Douglass?
I'm just asking.
No. It's a good question to ask. It's a good question to ask. I think that I've read a lot about Frederick Douglass's life, done a lot of programs around his life over the years. And so I come to kind of understand him. And the portrait you painted of him was one that most people don't paint because they put it in the background, whether it's just drinking and the women in his life and his lasciviousness and stuff like that, that's not something that people usually put on the page. Do you know what I mean? So that was...
Yeah, but...
Go ahead.
Yeah, but he did it, though.
Yeah, but...
I mean,
right.
He certainly... I mean, I that doesn't mean he's a... Look, don't meet your heroes.
Right.
You know.
Exactly.
It just so happened that the circumstances of Frederick Douglass's life intersected with John Brown's life. In real life, John Brown planned in part, his raid on Harper's Ferry at Frederick Douglass's house. And since Onion was John Brown's consort, it was just too delicious to turn away the opportunity to create this really funny scene that really speaks not so much to Frederick Douglass and, you know, how he wanted to get laid or whatever, but just how people treat women.
Right.
How people treat young girls, then and now.
Exactly. I think what you just said is very important for anybody to hear, which is if you don't meet your heroes if you can't handle the complexity of a human being and the breadth of a human being.
Yeah. And it should be said that Frederick Douglass was very helpful in terms of the Harper's Ferry attack, although just before he attacked Harper's Ferry, John Brown went to Frederick Douglass. They met in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and he asked Frederick Douglass to join him. He said, if you join me, the Negroes will flock to our side by the thousands. And Frederick Douglass said, I'm a man of words. I'm not a soldier. And it's a suicide mission. And so he refused to go. But his right-hand man, or the fellow that was with him.
Emperor.
Who was nicknamed the Emperor. Yeah, Emperor went. And he died there. He was hung. And a braver man you never met.
And I the characters you put in here are all very real, and I grew up also with this kind of love of John Brown, which is why I was dying to read this book. Because it says a lot about what human beings can, should, or would be willing to do to change a terrible wrong.
Well, I was surprised. I mean, there must have been there are probably 30 or 40 books written about John Brown.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised that people know so little about him still. I mean, he should be like Jesse James, because he was a true hero. This is a white man who in 1855 decided that blacks were equal, that God had said it, the Bible had said it, and that he was going to live like it, and he was going to do something about it. And he sacrificed himself and three of his sons to the cause of abolitionism. And Harriet Tubman, who really is the defining word about the anti-slavery movement, had a tremendous amount of respect for John Brown. And in fact, John Brown called Harriet Tubman General. And he was the only, she was the only one that he would address as a as an inferior.
As a superior.
As a superior, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
He felt, you know, superior to most people, so he would, he called himself captain, he called her general.
Right. The old man.
Right.
I mean, I think you're right. I think that's why this is important in some ways. People need to understand who John Brown, what he stood for in that period of history, what the 1850s meant, you know, from all over this country, from the Fugitive Slave Act to what happened in Harper's Ferry to the Christiana Rebellion in 1851. This is a very, that decade was an incredible decade.
It was. It was a true turning point. It was probably more important than the Industrial Revolution in terms of how America was shaped and formed to become what it is now. And John Brown had a tremendous amount to do with that. And also the subject of religion and how it played into, how he shoehorned it into the abolitionist movement. It just became impossible to continue to say that you were a Christian and believed in God and believed in the Constitution and continue to support slavery. Because the pro-slavery movement was very brutal. It was intellectual, but it was also very brutal. I mean, Preston Brooks, the senator from South Carolina, beat Charles Sumner, senator from Massachusetts, right, to a pulp in the halls of Congress. And then he got a whole bunch of canes in the mail because he broke his cane, so lots of people sent him canes to they sent him canes to,
right,
you know, to replace the one that he broke.
That stuff still
that
happens.
That was the level of discourse.
That still happens on some levels. You know, when George Zimmerman did what he did, he got all this money in the mail and money for guns.
That's true. It shows that we still have a long way to go. Listen, people who are wrong, they always have to howl the loudest. They're always screaming hard. But if you're on the right side of what God and history is about, then you just be cool. It'll work itself out.
So what I have to ask you a question before I again jump into the heart of some of the characters in this book and what you've written here and what you've discovered. What did you discover doing this book? What did you find out that wasn't there for James McBride?
Well, one thing that I knew before I started this book, but I came away with even deeper belief with, is that the stereotypical view of slavery that we have is, with both, number one, both wrong, and number two, damaging to our current psyche. Because slavery was a really complicated web of relationships. We were truly bound together. And what John Brown did was he walked into this web of relationships that existed with what amounted to a pair of scissors, and he just began snipping away and freeing blacks wherever he went. And it caused basically the equivalent of arteries just bursting all over the place and led this country to civil war. So I just came to appreciate how unspoken moral courage of millions of Americans is so rarely appreciated by those of us who walk around today.
I when I was reading the book, one of the things that struck me, and maybe it's because I had just listened to this music before I started reading your book, but you know the song Signifying Monkey?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I was just listening to that old album, and before I started reading the book, and started reading about Onion, and I started seeing Onion as a signifying monkey.
Deep in the jungle, and the way the coconut grows, up jumped the monkey wearing a one-button roll. He wore keen-toed shoes and a split in his coat. He was a sharp little monkey. That ain't no joke. I know that all. My Uncle Walter he taught me that stuff.
That's a great song.
That was a Oscar Brown,
yes,
Junior song, but it was also, I mean, it's also based on a black folktale that,
right,
made it up through the ages. I suppose you could say Onion was kind of this signifying monkey. He's a, you know, he's basically, this book is a 111-year-old black man telling a gigantic whopper. He's just sitting around the fire. I mean, basically, he's telling this to a fellow deacon,
right,
in a church in Delaware in 1941. But I love that kind of language. I love people who talk like that. A lot of relatives who talk like that, and it's delicious for storytelling.
No, it is. I mean, there's a way that folks, especially from the South, and in the black culture, have of telling stories that is mesmerizing, which is what this kind of the lilt and language and the way you wrote this was in that way of thinking, feeling, speaking, talking.
Well, it's magnetic.
Yeah,
it pulls the reader. You know, you can take the reader any way you want. I love this character, and I
must
say this is one book. Yeah, I love the character Onion, and this is one book that I was really sorry that I had to write the words "the end" at the end of it, because I just loved this character. I loved to hear him talk, and I just loved his attitude. You know,
and his growth and changes he went through in this book.
Well, he does go through a lot of transformations. He starts out being happy to work in a tavern and sip, you know, ale and wolf down Johnny Cake and the things they ate back then. And then he's kidnapped and he's free and he's hungry all the time. And he says it several times in the book that he was more hungry when he was free than he ever was as a slave.
Right.
But ultimately, his transformation for deciding that he's going to stop pretending to be a girl, he's going to just be a man and deal with that and let everyone know, really helps him become someone who wants to be free and understands what freedom is. And that's that's a moral lesson that's really pertinent now. We have, you know, 50-year-old black men, not just black men, 50-year-old men walking around wearing baseball caps and shorts and dressing
right,
like kids.
Right, right. Know? But no, it's not just black men. We do. We have this because we have a very adolescent view of the world, I think, in this country in many ways.
Yeah, sometimes I think it just all boils down to, like, you know, if you don't drink Sprite and obey your thirst, you know, you're just not gonna be happy. I feel like it's a big commercial we're living in. So this book speaks to the kinds of people who really believed in the American principles of equality and justice and sacrifice for it, and they came from all walks of life.
Which is another thing I'm going to come some of the specifics you come out in this book I think are important for people to hear. We're going to take a brief break here and come right back with James McBride talking about his latest work, The Good Lord Bird. And James, are there any pieces you want to think about reading when we come back from break?
Yeah, I'll read from Sabonia's speech when she decides to not confess.
That's a good part. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Coltrane, come back with the man himself, Ray Charles, both born on this day. We're here with James McBride, The Good Lord Bird, his latest work. And James, you were going to read a piece about Sabonia.
Right. During the middle of the book, the protagonist, Henry, finds himself stuck with some pro-slavers in Missouri. And during this period, he's working in a brothel. During this time, there's an insurrection that's discovered, and the people in town find that there were 8 or 9 blacks who were involved in this, and they decide they want to make the leader of this insurrection confess, because they think there might be more, and they think like 40 or 50 people involved. They bring her in, they threaten to hang her and pull her apart and pour tar down her throat, and she refuses to tell. So they bring in the reverend because they know she likes the minister. And they say, go to the jailhouse, and she'll talk to you because she likes you. So this is the reverend. The reverend went to the jailhouse, and then he came back to the tavern to tell the people what happened. And so I'm reading from that, the reverend's account of what happened in prison when he went to see Sabonia, the slave who was heading the insurrection that was foiled. The reverend said, Sabonia, I've come to find out everything you know about the wicked insurrection. And she cut me off. She said, Reverend, you come for no such purpose. Maybe you was persuaded to come or forced to come. But would you, who taught me the word of Jesus, the man who taught me that Jesus suffered and died in truth, would you tell me to betray confidence secretly entrusted in me? Would you, who taught me that Jesus' sacrifice was for me and me only, would you now ask me to forfeit the lives of others who would help me? Reverend, you know me. The reverend said, but Sabonia, yours was a wicked plot. Had you succeeded, the streets would run red with blood. How could you plot to kill so many innocent people, to kill me and my wife? What have my wife and I done to you? And here she looked at me sternly and said, Reverend, it was you and your wife who taught me that God is no respecter of persons. It was you and your missus who taught me that in his eyes we are all equal. I was a slave. My husband was a slave. My children were slaves. But they were all sold, every one. And after the last child was sold, I said, I will strike a blow for freedom. I had a plan, Reverend, but I failed. I was betrayed. But I tell you now, if I had succeeded, I would have slain you and your wife first to show them that followed me that I could sacrifice my love as I ordered them to sacrifice their hates to have justice for them. I would have been miserable for the rest of my life. I could not kill any human creature and feel any less. But in my heart, God tells me I was right. And here the reverend sagged in his chair. I was overpowered, he said. I could not answer easily. Sabonia's honesty was so sincere, I forgot everything in my sympathy for her. I didn't know what I was doing. I lost my mind. I grasped her by the hand and said, Sibby, let us pray. And we prayed long and earnestly. I prayed to God as our common Father. I acknowledged that he would do justice, that those deemed the worst by us might be regarded the best by him. I prayed for God to forgive Sibby, and if we was wrong, to forgive the whites. I pressed Sibby's hand when I was done and received the warm pressure of hers pressing mine in return. And with a joy I never experienced before, I heard her earnest, solemn amen as I closed. The reverend stood up. I ain't for this infernal institution no more, he said. Hang her if you want, but find someone else to minister to this town, for I am finished with it. And with that, he got up and left the room.
One of the things you do so well in this book, I think you also did in Song Yet Sung, is to get under this, in a literal way, figurative way, under the skin of slavery, of the nuances of it, of what, how people, different people survived in it, attitudes about it, ways they behaved, whether you're talking about pie or Sabonia or onion or the railway man or the woman who with the broom who came to their door in Harper's Ferry, and what she said about, you know, she's free but people left behind, all of that. It's just, it was a complex institution. How people responded and lived, were forced to live in it, was a complexity on its own, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, well, we live in a, we have to tell ourselves certain things so we can go to bed at night feeling good about what we've done during the course of the day. And slavery represented a tremendous problem for everyone by the time the 1850s rolled around. Because by then, slaves were really, this whole business of freedom, Harriet Tubman, for example, was operating in full effect. And the Fugitive Slave Act had thrown the cause of slavery, the cause of abolitionism into everyone's newspaper. And people were just trying to cope with it because it was an economic engine upon which the country demanded. I mean, I suppose the crude example would be our energy policy now. John Brown stole slaves from people. Slaves had value. Well, I'm against global warming. But if you steal my car because you're against global warming, I'm not going to be happy about it. So, what you have to do when you approach slavery as a writer, so that you don't fall into sort of the standard, Kunta Kinte, Alex Haley approach, or the Gone with the Wind approach, is to realize that everybody was trying to do the right thing, even though the right thing wasn't always the right thing, or it depended on who you were talking to.
For you, that also means the slavers?
Sure. Yeah. Most white people didn't own slaves. And those that did, many of those that did, felt they were doing a service to African Americans because they felt they were just superior to them. There's still white people who feel superior to African Americans now. They don't even know they feel superior. They can't be blamed for that. Our job is to educate each other so that our job is to give each other space so that each side can understand where the other lives. Now, that's not good politics. When you're asking someone to pay taxes for something that they claim I had nothing to do with slavery. So I don't even know how to respond to that kind of stupidity. Because it's just basically but saying, it was good in the good old days and girls were girls and boys. That's just basically trying to absolve yourself of the responsibility of caring about your fellow American. So I think basically we just have to give ourselves room to care for each other. Now, if you want to just make fun of it and say, I'm waiting for the Hopi changey stuff, then you're just ignorant and there's nothing to be done about you. But maybe your kids, maybe we should, we'll just focus on them.
I mean, you've done that in your books. I mean, the humanity, you find humanity in all these characters.
Well, I believe people are trying to do the right thing. I think people try to do the best they can. For example, Chase, who's a pro-slaver, who essentially kidnaps Onion.
Right.
He ends up becoming a pretty good friend. I mean, they're alcoholics together. They get boozed up and howl at the moon, but this really happens. Look, it happens in my life. I don't run with the kinds of folks who are so politically correct or incorrect that you can't tell me a dirty joke.
But even Dutch, who owned Onion in the first place.
Yeah, well, Onion says at the top, he said, when Dutch gets into it with John Brown, Onion says, well, I'm going to say right here and now that my sympathies were with the Dutch. Dutch fed us well, and we did what we wanted to do, and, it wasn't so bad. Eventually, though, he's got to leave Dutch's. Look, life just pushes you along.
Right.
And it depends on how you adjust to that push. That's the quality of your life. You just have to forgive the past and just keep on rolling.
You do. I mean, that most people don't do that, and I think that's one of the dilemmas of our human situation. I'm going to jump into this John Brown thing for a minute. One of the things I loved about this book was the John Brown's crew. Whether it was his first crew, his second crew, his sons, they were just some bad boys. They weren't
They were dangerous fellas.
They were dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah, they were downright dangerous. And they were not all Christians. Most of them had some, spiritual belief, but they were young guys, most of them white guys, supported by their wives and female friends, who attacked America's biggest arsenal, knowing they'd be killed. One of the guys who got hung after John Brown was captured was a guy named John A. Copeland, who was an Oberlin student. I mean, no, cheap plug. I went to Oberlin as well. So, But he was the only college student there.
Right.
And when they hung him, the prosecutor, Andrew Hunter, said, "This is as fine a young man as I've come across, and it's a shame that he got himself mixed up with these bad people." Some of these guys were, and these guys were really intelligent men, and they were dedicated to this cause. What really ruined John Brown was that he actually captured Harper's Ferry. He had it for a day and a half. It was his. And he could have walked away. He could have gotten away. But he was waiting for the black folks to show up.
Right.
That's like me waiting for my drummer to show up in rehearsal. You know? You know, we got a hit record here. It's going to come, but waiting for this dude. I mean, in all seriousness, I think John Brown misunderstood. I should mention, though, there's a lot of evidence to indicate that there were more blacks with John Brown and preparing to join him than we previously knew. And some of those blacks came from the Baltimore and Washington, D.C. area.
And that was part of the role that the railway man played, and Onion forgetting to do the things he forgot to do. I keep calling her she, he. The guy got me doing it, reading the book.
I had to think of Onion as a girl when I was...
Right.
Well, Onion was supposed to tell the railman, he was supposed to give, the railman gave John Brown's men, what happened was the railman was a porter.
Right.
On the B&O Railroad. And the train was supposed to be, John Brown and his men to stop both trains that came, particularly the one that came out of Baltimore. And the railman was supposed to hear a signal from John Brown's men to release the blacks that he brought from Baltimore and Washington to join John Brown. But Onion forgot to tell the old man, meaning John Brown, about the rail man's signal. He forgot to give him the signal because he fell in love with John Brown's daughter, and he was all hung up with that about whether or not he should try to tell. Because she hugged him, and he was getting all, you know, the hair on the back of his neck was standing on end. He just couldn't stand it. So he forgot to tell John Brown about the signal. And so when the whole Harper's Ferry thing breaks, the rail man comes out waiting for the signal. He said he would not release his men unless he saw the signal from John Brown's man. And he never sees the signal. And they end up shooting him. John Brown's men end up shooting the railway man. And that is based on the true story. The first person killed at Harper's Ferry was the black porter on the B&O Railroad. And the theory is that he was the guy who had brought blacks on that train because... when that train was stopped, the white passengers were frightened to see all of these black people walking away from the train in the other direction. And this guy, his name was Haywood Shepherd. He died with several thousand dollars in the bank. I think he had $1,700 in the bank.
That's a lot of money in 1859.
That's a lot of money. So that's one of the things that's pointed out in the book.
It is, and I like how you handled that. I mean, that because one of the things here that Again, the power of the institution of slavery and being owned by that system, in that system as a slave, the different ways people dealt with it, whether it was, you know, the coachman's wife would just go along, get along, don't bother me, to those who were actually active involved in the underground, who were willing to fight for freedom on different levels. And that complexity is important to understand, too.
Oh, of course. People who were in the abolitionist movement had varying degrees of involvement. It was a very complicated spy network in which you could lose your life pretty easily if you blabbed to the wrong person. So the coachman's wife, she's not part of the Underground Railroad, whereas the coachman is in it up to his neck. And Onion blunders into this, not knowing anything about the Underground Railroad.
Didn't know a thing.
In fact, when he knew nothing.
Nothing.
When he first meets the coachman keeps, you know, gives him certain signs, and the kid doesn't know what, Onion doesn't know what the heck he's talking about. He kind of backs into it. He has to figure out the Underground Railroad to try to roust up the blacks, as he's ordered to do by old John Brown. And it doesn't quite work out the way John Brown wanted it to work out, which was really the pattern of John Brown's life, frankly.
Right, and the pattern of John Brown's life is like, he's clearly over the edge. He's a madman.
Oh yeah. Well,
but right.
Yeah, he's overzealous. That's what you know. They he's been portrayed as a madman, but people thought Coltrane was mad when Coltrane started playing free jazz.
That's true.
I'm not sure that he was mad.
Well, maybe that was the wrong choice of words on my part.
Well,
I mean,
you might be right. I'm not quite sure. I wouldn't attack Harper's Ferry with 19 other people.
Wait, so you would have just stayed back with Frederick?
Yeah, I would have been a Frederick Douglass, I think. Yeah. I'm a lover, not a fighter, one of those.
But you love John Brown, and you love the men who went with him.
Well, I just admire him so much. I admire someone who really can't unloop themselves from the truth, because there's a lot of pain in that.
Right.
As a writer, you know, you live in a world where you're always trying to see the truthful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And no, it hurts me to see how so few Americans know their history and what they've allowed themselves to become. You know, just overeaters who just over-consumers, just co-opting any culture that comes here so that we just become one big fat McDonald's.
Yep.
It's just, it bothers me. So, but I'm not John Brown, and I'm not going to blow up any McDonald's just in case any of your listeners get that, you know. But I just admired him for being trying to be so honest and pure.
I mean, he was the antithesis of the America you're describing. He wouldn't accept it. He couldn't accept it. I mean,
yeah, and he was, but I should say that he was admired greatly by members of high society and a lot of rich people. John Brown was funded by abolitionists in Boston and New York and Philadelphia, probably Baltimore and D.C. as well. And when he, after Harper's Ferry, a lot of these people, particularly the Secret Six, six men in Boston who were primarily his fundraisers, they had to skedaddle. Frederick Douglass did too.
Right.
He suddenly had appointments in Europe that needed, you know, demanded his attention.
Well, you
had to run for his life.
That's interesting. So when you said that, it made me think of, and I don't want to digress on this too much, but it made me think of the 1960s and revolutionaries in the 1960s in America, whether it was against the war or people who became revolutionaries out of the civil rights movement. It was wealthy folks, and mostly wealthy white folks, not completely, but wealthy folks in New York and L.A. that supported them.
Well, I was a boy during that time, and I don't doubt that's true. I know that at some point, John Brown was mentioned in, or part of the Black Panther movement because he went into this whole business of trying to establish a provisional government.
Right.
Which brought on all kinds of, because that's what the Black Panthers essentially tried to do, and that brought on all kinds of death and mayhem and governmental tension for them.
So when you live in these historical periods, what do they say to you now? What does John Brown say about us now? Because, I mean, you lived in that 19th century, but you're right here right now.
That's a difficult question. I think the internet age has changed how we view each other and view the world. I don't think John Brown would be disappointed with what has evolved in America racially. I think he might be a little bit turned off by how religion has been used as a kind of baseball bat, where one side wars against the other. I think if he were alive, he'd be disappointed with the level of discourse that exists with regard to immigration and gay rights. And I think he might be a little disappointed in terms of how African Americans have shown themselves to be either silent or non-compliant with some of those issues, those two that I just mentioned.
One of the things that John Brown, and was very important in this book and through all of this, it was very clear from what you're writing here that John Brown believed in black folks who were slaves and black folks, period, in America at that point, having their own agency in this fight. It wasn't his, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it was like, he wasn't like a lot of other kind of white abolitionists, just kind of, it didn't seem to me from reading your book, who are, you know, when Onion looked at the room and said, there are all these people talking about black folks, but ain't nobody, not any black folks talking.
Right. No, John Brown was different in that regard, because he really saw the humanity of black people. And he understood instinctively that African Americans have to be at the forefront of their struggle, their own struggle. So he wasn't one of these people who, like, you know, I know your pain better than you, and you know,
right?
He was one of, he was a true humanist, and he saw the humanity in people. It should be mentioned that he had one son named Frederick.
Yeah, I love that character.
Mentally disabled, and that, and I think that helped him sympathize with those who could not express their dreams and hopes as well as they wanted to. You know, I know many members of my own family who when they say to me, "That's good, man," or they say, "Boy, that, you know, you did good, all the way out in full," I know they mean it from the bottom of their hearts, and they need me, or would not be displeased if I expressed it for them in a more fuller and more educated and refined way. But the heart part of it, the giving part of it, is so true and real. And I think John Brown felt that from African-American people. I think people misunderstand how trusting and kind the African-American community is, particularly now, you know, in this world of hip-hop. And, you know, you got to be, every time you see a movie with an African-American kid, he's got to be cool, and he's the one that dances the blah, blah. You know, it's stupid crap. And I think people misunderstand how kind and loyal and trusting African Americans are in general. I think John Brown got that. In fact, I think a lot of slavery owners understood that as well, and that's one reason why slavery lasted so long.
Absolutely. I think you really hit it right there. Before we have to go, James, two quick questions. A listener just called in saying, his book club's reading Song Yet Sung. Has anybody wanted to make that into a movie yet? Someone just wrote in to ask.
Well, actually, that that might happen soon.
It'd be a great movie.
There may
do
be
it right.
A television series based on it.
It would be great.
Yeah, and we're talking about that now.
So the good Lord Birdman, was the ivory-billed woodpecker, was that story real?
Yes.
That really
was? The ivory-billed woodpecker is a giant woodpecker that was known, no, basically more in Missouri than Kansas.
The bird's real, but I mean was real or is real, but was the story real about what that bird meant?
No.
Okay.
No, that, I just picked that up.
Just wanted to check if that was some stuff, historical fact, that was James' big ride. Finding a vehicle.
That's it. Yeah, just some symbolic, you know, a metaphorical object.
Okay. I wasn't sure. I had to ask.
But, I mean, it's important that people know that this book is funny and that it's not depressing.
No, it's not depressing.
I don't like history books that are, you know, depressing. It's a funny book meant to inform and entertain.
You're writing it like you're doing a piece of improv on the stage with words. I just love it. It's just, it just pop, 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 comes at you, and it's very funny. And also thought-provoking, not just funny. I love each one of your books has a different twist. This is twisted a different way than the others.
Well, I was a lot more freer in this book because I had a character who could just tell it like it is.
Onion.
Yeah, so the onion could just tell it like it is. You know, an old man, he can say what he really saw, and it helps. It helps me as the writer.
Well, I deeply appreciate you bringing John Brown to life and creating Onion for us. And I want to remind you all out there, James McBride, the good Lord Bird, he will be here this Saturday at the Baltimore Book Festival at 3 p.m. You don't want to miss the conversation with James McBride. I'm going to get down there to hear it myself, book in hand. Don't miss it. And he has given us The Color of Water, Songs Yet Sung, Miracle at Santa Ana, now The Good Lord Bird. And James McBride, thank you so much, man. I appreciate you for writing the book and for joining us today.
I'm delighted. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
I appreciate it. See you on Saturday.
Okay, I'll see you there.
All right, take care.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. So that was our conversation with James McBride, and I would say please read this book, an amazing book. I couldn't put it down. You can just stay with it for like 6-7 hours and just enjoy and consume. I want to remind you that on the way out of here, the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Henry and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineers, Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. You can hear the show again, podcast and our past shows, find out information about our guests, what they're writing, thinking, and doing by going to steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast now on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Michelle Martin coming up behind me. Take care. We'll talk tomorrow.
Love to free, love to free, love to free, love to free.